compelled to testify about his alleged source. Risen's won support from news organizations, including NPR. But the U.S. Justice Department told the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to let the issue rest. Prosecutors say there's no safe harbor from testimony when journalists are the only eyewitnesses to a crime. A justice official predicted to NPR, though, that the case would not end with Risen going to jail rather than take the stand about his source. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Retailers in the U.S. are doing a better job of keeping tobacco out of the hands of minors. That's according to a federal report. It says the sale of tobacco to minors last year was near all-time lows. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Al Jazeera America, introducing a new TV news channel. There's more to it. Local listings at aljazeera.com/America.
And now, Jay Leno.
Late Night Week continues on the next Fresh Air. We'll feature an interview I recorded with Jay Leno in 1996, just before his fifth anniversary as the host of The Tonight Show. And we'll hear my interview with Conan O'Brien, recorded in 2003, when he was celebrating his 10th anniversary as the host of Late Night. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WYLL. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. While we're not taking calls this hour, you can join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. I don't have any memories of, at least not much, of consciously learning things from comic books. There are a few exceptions, and one of them that I can think of was a Disney comic book from the 1960s. It was called Uncle Scrooge and Money. And I've come to understand that it was a comic book adaptation of a Disney educational cartoon. And both the movie and the comic book have this sugar-coated history of the types of money down the ages. And a quick example from Scrooge McDuck of supply and demand capitalism. I didn't have many of these educational moments growing up, however. Comics, when I was a kid, comics were mainly for children, but they weren't considered a respectable means of educating them. Today, comics are considered respectable enough for adults to read, but my guests today are interested in using comics to educate kids, either to teach them specific things or perhaps simply to teach them what they can learn just simply through the act of reading comics, technically. And they're not stopping at Uncle Scrooge, either. Join me in the studio is Carol Tilley. She's an assistant professor of library and information science at the University of Illinois. She's recently gained attention for a journal article noting flaws in the methodology in the research in the book Seduction of the Innocent. That was psychologist Frederick Wortham's muckraking book from the 1950s that accused comics of encouraging juvenile delinquency. Professor Tilley, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim.
And our other guest, Joshua Elder, writes kids' comics for a living. I think he may be best known for the series Mail Order Ninja. That's my guess, because all copies of the Mail Order Ninja books at the Champaign and Urbana Public Libraries appeared to have been checked out yesterday, so I had a lot of trouble finding a copy. Josh Elder's newest venture is Reading with Pictures. It's a nonprofit organization that's trying to get comic book format textbooks into classrooms. Josh, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And Carol, you have a TED Talk available online in which you argue for comic books as a good way to educate children, including teaching them to read. It's what is it about comics that make them a good medium for that sort of thing?
Well, I think that comics, first of all, can capture kids' attention often in a way that traditional texts can't. They're often colorful. They're about kid-friendly topics in many instances. But in terms of reading, I think that comics have a lot going on because they do have words and they do have pictures, but those two things together create something that's more than the sum of its parts. So it's about making meaning from the words, making meaning from the pictures, and making meaning from how those two things interact with one another to create something wholly new.
And Josh, according to your organization, Reading with Pictures, the website, you're working with a publisher to create a line of graphic textbooks that I guess put the ideas Carol mentions into practice?
Yeah, that's correct. Working with Lorenz Educational Press on this project, that, and it's really something we've been wanting to do as an organization since we were founded back in 2009. It just took, you know, a long time to sort of get all the pieces in place, but the general idea of using comics to not be supplemental reading, but can we be a direct one-to-one replacement for traditional text materials in certain instances? That's what we're trying to do with the graphic textbook project, is show that comics can be just as good as traditional text materials, and in many cases, perhaps even better.
We also invite your input on this, if you've ever learned anything from the comics, and I mean more than the difference between green kryptonite and red kryptonite. If you have stories about the role comics played in your childhood, call us at 333-9455, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Josh, would this be a first, the project you're working on, using comics in a classroom setting?
Well, I mean, there's been a number of comics designed with explicit educational purposes in mind, and a number of comics that have, you know, by hook or by crook, appeared in classrooms over the years. Art Spiegelman's Mouths, of course, is a staple in a lot of high schools across the country. And then you get work like the Cartoon History of the Modern World, or the Cartoon History or the Cartoon Guide to Statistics by former Harvard math professor Larry Gonick. So there's a lot of material that's out there, but it's always been there's a world of difference in the educational universe between textbooks and educational materials. And educational materials are things that a teacher typically buys on his or her own dime. They're brought out and used once all the real reading and the real work is done. And we think those are great, and we want to, you know, fill that role to a point. But we also want to see if we can be the show. Can comics be the focus of teaching, rather than sort of the thing that orbits around it? And that's what we're trying to prove with the graphic textbook. And so we've aligned the materials to what's called the Common Core Curriculum, which is a new nationwide initiative that's rolling out now, and that's going to, you know, require a lot of new types of learning, a lot of new types of material. And we've aligned our product with that. So we'll be really the first Common Core aligned comic book project out there.
I can understand if you have a deep love of comics wanting to do that, but just in general, why do you think it's important for comics to be at the center of the show as far as education is concerned?
Well, you know, echoing what Professor Tilly said, I think that, you know, we call it the three E's of comics in the classroom: engagement, you know, that basically the material, like Professor Tilly said, they'll engage with it in the way they won't with regular materials, and especially with troubled readers, they will glom onto this material the way they won't touch anything else. Then we call it, the second E is efficiency, and this material, you can cram more information because you're using both words and pictures together, and as we all know, a picture can be worth 1,000 words. So you use these in an optimal way, you can actually put more information in front of a reader, and they can digest it in less time. And then the idea of efficacy, when you pair words and images together, it's a neurological theory called the dual coding theory of cognition, which says that images and words are basically processed in separate parts of the brain. And when you pair the two of them together, you often get both greater comprehension and then greater long-term retention. Sort of the whole A is for Apple idea, scaled up tremendously and then applied to virtually any kind of topic or concept you can imagine.
Let me get back to that thread of discussion in a moment. Let me take in a caller right now, though, on line one, Jeff in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you very much. I have two very separate questions. One is, I believe my wife wrote a paper one time for Professor Tilley, and it was about something I remember from my childhood called Classics Illustrated, and they were comic books, but they were on extremely canonical, traditional texts like Ivanhoe or Last of the Mohicans. I was wondering how those were looked upon in their time and today. My second question is, as I listen about the learning theory behind comics, is that being replaced with virtual reality, gaming, avatars, all those kinds of things as educational tools, things that might surpass and even be more effective than graphic novels, graphic textbooks? Thank you, and I'll listen offline.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. I remember Classics Illustrated because they weren't necessarily the best comics around, but I do remember some of them in my childhood. Can literary works survive in a useful way in adaptation like that?
You know, absolutely. So Classics Illustrated got their start in the early 1940s, and they were a little bit different than a lot of the comics at the time because they weren't dated, so they could stay on the newsstands longer, and they were a little bit more expensive. But they sold really well. They were popular with kids often in the 1940s and 1950s as a substitute for the books they had to do for read for book reports. So they were the bane of many English teachers in grade schools and secondary schools at that time. They were never really highly regarded by teachers because they felt too watered down. At the same time, though, you can sort of fast forward to today, and there is a growing market in literary adaptations in comics form for kids, some directly for the educational market. So there are some series that adapt works of Shakespeare for use in classrooms. But then there are also adaptations of popular literary works. So, for instance, Twilight, which has been a big young adult series, has a manga adaptation. Jean Duprou's City of Ember series has a comics adaptation. So there are a growing number of contemporary books for young people that also are being translated and adapted into comics form.
Josh, I'm wondering, since the project you're working on with the publisher would include English curriculum, are you thinking just more on language skills, or would there be a place or a use for adaptation of works in comics?
So, I mean, I think in our context specifically, these are we're dealing more with, like, for instance, the ones that we're actually dealing with in the first iteration of the graphic textbook in the language arts section are onomatopoeia and vocabulary and sort of word usage. So it's more grammar and language usage. And then, again, a lot of vocabulary is spread across all the different projects, including the ones about science and math. So we're not doing that yet, but when you look at the value of adaptation, and that goes back to that efficiency element I mentioned before, every year there's literally more to know, and the school day doesn't get any longer, the school year doesn't get any longer. We've got to enhance the speed of instruction and the efficiency of instruction just to keep up, much less get ahead. And if comics can allow you to basically get an effective summary of a work and what you need to know from it, the themes, the ideas, certain elements of the language that can certainly translate and be translated with perfect fidelity and survive in the comic form, then that's all you really need. And reading the entire book, you know, which would probably take anywhere between 3, 4, 5 times as long as reading, say, the Classics Illustrated adaptation, isn't perhaps a good use of the student's time or the teacher's time. And, you know, is this the truth? Is this you know, the absolute only way to go. I'm not advocating that because I don't know, because we've never really tried an alternative. And one of the things we're doing at Reading with Pictures is trying to create accountability for the stuff we create, because it's all tied to a big research study being overseen by Dr. David Rath of the Learning Sciences Department at Northwestern University. So we really want to test what we're trying to do and find out if we're right or not, because, you know, frankly, we don't know because nobody knows.
And, you know, another question that Jeff brought up, what's the role of comics, which are still, you know, still images printed on paper, when video games and other moving images on computers are becoming just so ubiquitous in kids' lives?
Well, I can, I've also spent some time as a video game designer and writer. I worked for Disney Interactive for a year on an Avengers game. So I've been in the belly of that beast too. And everything we're developing at the Graphic Textbook is also designed to live digitally. In fact, we're optimizing the pages to be read on a screen rather than printed on a page. And ideally, we plan to have certain interactive learning elements embedded in it. That's a question for our technology partners, whoever they end up being. We're searching for some right now. But we absolutely think that, you know, I certainly believe that interactive learning can, you know, both increase the effectiveness and the efficiency of instruction. And I think, you know, the stuff that we're seeing in from institutions like the Khan Academy or Coursera with its distributed higher learning tools, this is where it's going to go. You know, we're going to see this more and more often, and it's going to create more and more powerful feedback loops so that we actually know what students are learning as they're learning it. And that will, you know, increase the effectiveness and efficiency of instruction, and everybody will win.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about how comic books can help kids learn with comic book writer Joshua Elder, whose latest project, Reading with Pictures, is geared towards encouraging the creation of graphic textbooks for the classroom. Also in the studio, University of Illinois Library and Information Science Professor Carol Tilley, an advocate of comics as a positive force in children's lives. And Josh, you were kind enough to send us, I guess these are all still in the formative stages, but you sent us some scripts and preliminary sketches for some of the books that might be in this in this curriculum with the publisher that you're working with. And I was looking at the one on George Washington in the Action President series. I like that title. And I was struck, you know, what you're doing. And, you know, looking back to my childhood, I remember the children's biographies that I've read. I guess they did it in their own way, but you're doing it much more sharply, as, you know, specific images that would, I guess, are meant to leave an impression in a kid's mind. They may border a little bit on caricature, but it can still be a useful image. I'm on the page where you know, one panel depicts the federal government under the Articles of Confederation. This is a rather complex topic, but you depict the federal government as a small, furry, tribble-like creature in a small cage, wide-eyed and panting. Looming all around it are the feet and shins and ankles of the labeled states, its omnipotent owners. And you're essentially showing how ineffective the federal government was in the Articles of Confederation, which I gather will lead in a few panels to the call for a new federal government and the U.S. Constitution.
And that's a work by the tremendous Fred Van Lente and Ryan Dunleavy, who were the first people we recruited for the graphic textbook, because they are well known as a team for a series called Action Philosophers, which takes this same sort of tongue-in-cheek look at the world of philosophy, but is in fact the best introductory philosophy textbook I've ever encountered. And I took more than my share of philosophy courses when I was at Northwestern. My best friend was a philosophy major. You know, we You know, we've seen it all. And what Action Philosophers did was make it relatable, digestible, and extremely entertaining and accessible. And we had them bring the same idea to the world of history and politics with their Action Presidents.
Do we have any idea about how this actually works with kids? I mean, I don't know what sort of research is available, but you're talking about you're coming across this sort of stuff as when you were a college kid. If you're a middle school kid, you may be taking things in differently. And even if we have these striking images, is it going to work? That's what it comes down to as far as the information that kids can retain.
Well, I'll leave the research base to Professor Tilly, but I want to share a personal anecdote before I pass the mic. Reading with pictures exists because, for lack of a better term, Hooked on Comics worked for me. When I was a little boy, my mother is a school librarian, and she would read to me every night before putting me to bed. And occasionally she'd let me pick the book, and I would almost always pick a comic. And so I had chosen an issue of the Transformers, and Mom was reading it and had, you know, some laryngitis or something and lost her voice about halfway through the issue. And this was completely unacceptable because Optimus Prime was in a lot of danger, you know, and I had to make sure it was going to be okay. And so I used the comic to teach myself how to read the comic. And I was able to reverse engineer words I didn't already know using visual context. I was able to follow the thrust of the narrative and glean the major character relationships from the images alone. And using that comic, I was able to finish the comic in about 2 weeks. And it basically became this, you know, stepladder for me for reading, starting from that point on, to the point that I was reading at the college level as a fifth grader. I took the SAT test, and I scored high enough to get admission to my local community college as a sixth grader, and, you know, went on to be a National Merit Scholar at Northwestern, and then now I'm a huge disappointment to everybody because I, you know, work in comics. But comics were my secret weapons in my secret educational weapons throughout my entire educational career. And if they could do that for me, then maybe they could do that for everybody. So that's kind of my personal story. And now I'll turn it over to Professor Tilly, who's got all the smartitude, to tell you about, like, what the actual science says.
And Carol, we were talking about this a little bit before we went on the air, and that, you know, this is not how comics were regarded decades ago. I had mentioned the paper that you had published about Frederick Wortham's methodology. And just to give a little background, there was a huge backlash against the comics industry in the late 1940s, after World War II, going into the mid-1950s, which led to an industry content code and pretty much the implosion of the comics industry. Fans think of it as the transition from the Golden Age to the Silver Age, I guess. But what it meant was that there were many fewer comics on the market, and they were much milder. But writers like Frederick Wortham, who wrote a best-selling book called Seduction of the Innocent, argued that comics were just bad, at best harmless, but mostly bad. And he even devoted a chapter to essentially saying the opposite of what you just told us, Josh, from your personal experience. Wortham didn't think they could teach you to read either. I mean, here's a quote from the chapter. An important area where comics do specific harm is the acquisition of fluent left-to-right eye movements, which is so indispensable for good reading. The eyes have to form the habit of going from left to right in the printed line, then returning quickly to the left at a point slightly lower. Reversal tendencies and confusions are common among children at the age of 6 as better reading habits are acquired, including the all-important left-to-right movements. Reversals and other errors gradually diminish and may automatically disappear. It is different with the comic book reader who acquires the habit of reading irregular printing here and there in balloons instead of complete lines from left to right. There it is, Joshua. Comics could not possibly have helped you learn to read.
And I just hope his mind would explode if he saw a webpage. That's all I can say.
Well, I have a couple of things I would follow up with that. Wortham was a really interesting person because a lot of the work he did was with kids who were in, for all intents and purposes, in dire straits. They were often kids who were truant from school, who had psychological issues, who had rough social circumstances in many ways. And so the kids that he based many of his ideas about comics and reading issues on were kids who had who were comics readers, yes, as 95% or more of all kids were at that time. But these were also kids who had reading disabilities or visual difficulties that existed independent of comics. So he had a very sort of strange group of kids, a very unique group of kids to base his ideas and insights on. But I would also add just a couple of other things. First of all, thinking about how comics help kids read, I think requires us to conceptualize reading in a different way, in a newer way than traditional, say, prose or expository text. Because there are words and there are pictures and they do different things in that text. And so to apply sort of old understandings of readings to comics reading just doesn't work, I think. The other thing I would add just really quickly is that there has been a long movement, especially in language arts education, for what's called multimodal literacy and multimodal teaching, which is goes back to what Josh was talking about with efficacy, the idea that as we combine more modes of learning, more modes of taking in information and producing information, we're likely to get more in general from it. And so comics are an approach to that kind of multimodal teaching and learning.
This does sound hypothetical to the point that has the research been done yet? Has anyone tried to look at kids reading comics and kids who don't read comics and see how their reading skills are affected and their ability to and their comprehension skills especially?
Well, it's really interesting. So if you go back to the 1940s, there were a lot of reading research studies done on comics that were often surveys of you know, how many comics did the average kid read each week. But there were a few that looked, for instance, to say, well, let's take a group of kids who are avid comics readers, and let's take a group of kids who aren't avid comics readers, and let's see how they compare. And what some of those early studies found is that kids who were avid comics readers, they were reading as well or better than the non-comics readers, and that they were reading more of everything in general. So comics wasn't was not detrimental to their overall reading. It wasn't detrimental to their overall reading fluency or success.
I don't see that research referred to in Frederick Wortham's book.
No,
and it does sound like it's a line of study that could use further research today.
Absolutely, and I believe that that's what David Rapp at Northwestern, who Josh mentioned, is working on now.
Well, it's time for a short break. We'll be back in a moment with more on how comics can educate kids. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, historically black colleges have been hit hard by the recession. We'll speak with the president of the Student Association at Howard University about the challenges his school faces.
The future of Howard is, I think, very, very solid. But we see these challenges as opportunities.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible with the support of the Friends of WILL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with U of I Library and Information Sciences Professor Carol Tilley and comics writer Joshua Elder of Reading with Pictures in Chicago. Joshua Elder, I was wondering, you're working with this publisher on a set of books, but I take it there must be some resistance to the idea of comic book format textbooks if you had to go to Kickstarter to raise money for this project.
So we went to Kickstarter because we had a very, very specific vision, and also I was personally very familiar with the platform. I'd run a successful Kickstarter with Reading with Pictures before. This second one was five times as successful. We really stepped our game up. But we knew what we wanted to do, and we had talked to a whole lot of different publishers who, you know, either work in graphic novels or work in the education space, and they always wanted to put what we were doing into one of their boxes. And, you know, that's just having worked in publishing and games in a number of different aspects over the years, I've seen that, you know, before. It didn't really surprise me. And, you know, people have a system in place for a reason. And we were saying, well, we have a different kind of idea. And the fact that they weren't willing to throw their complete support behind it on day one, that, you know, we expected that. And so that's why we went to Kickstarter, to try and prove that there was clearly a market for this. I think we did that. And now it's just a question of how big and how fast can we grow it beyond this first book. And that's, you know, that's the big challenge in front of us now. You know, we've kind of proven that there's a need out there. Now it's just a question of how big is it.
Something that I'm wondering about, to really get this into classrooms, you're not just going to have to convince, say, individual buyers, but you may have to convince bodies that set standards for a school district, are often even for an entire state. I think Texas is a gigantic example of that. Their panel that clears textbooks is very influential, simply because Texas is so large. Do you have any idea what sort of resistance you will meet with those bodies?
It'll probably be quite a bit. You know, depending again on the bigger the organization, the bigger the group we have to deal with. Frankly, the harder it is to even get in the room. You know, if you're not, it's politics. If you don't have the juice, you can't even get on their date book. And so we're operating a fairly lean operation. You know, many of our people are volunteers or working below their normal pay scale, especially in these early books, just because we believe in what we do. Plus, everyone who works on this in a creative capacity retains copyright and full use rights for everything they make. So, you know, we don't own what they produce, so they can take it and reuse it in their own series and stuff like that. So it's a better model for everyone and lets us get top-tier people for a much lower price than we otherwise could. We plan to approach the people who we think are the innovators in education already. And so we'd be going to magnet schools and charter schools, homeschool networks, private schools, places that are already at the cutting edge of, pedagogical theory, who are willing to experiment with different methods and different ideas because they kind of have that remit already. Our model's predicated on the idea that we just start with those places and we'll be successful. You know, we don't have to get Texas to say buy in. If they did, you know, that would be a bonanza and all of our dreams would come true and it would be all, you know, sunshine and lollipops forever. But we don't need for that to happen for this project to be a success and to grow successfully.
Let me go back to the phones, and on line one, Dave in Champaign is with us. Good morning, Dave. You're on
yes.
Focus.
Thank you. I think some of the lack of interest in comics was not so much the process as it was the content.
Some of it was very aggressive. The attitude to women was kind of strange, and ethnic background and things like that. So I think to a large extent the parents and others that were looking at this were looking at the content, not so much as the process. I very much believe in the process. Some of it you find in YouTube. There has been a reluctance to regard YouTube sometimes as an innovative event. But gradually that's been getting to be improved. It's archived and goes around the world, and it can include visual material. Could you say something about the content of topics?
And, Carol, maybe I could ask you about that, because that does go back into the history of comics and into the whole thing with Frederick Wortham. The comic book industry was once incredibly large, and from what I gathered, had been influenced by a new adult audience that came out of, you know, soldiers who started reading comics during World War II, and that was appearing on newsstands alongside with comics which were obviously marketed to kids.
Well, I want to go back even further than Wortham. I want to go back to the first decade of the 20th century when newspaper comic strips were first widely syndicated in the United States. And at a few different occasions around 1908 and again 1911-12, there were widespread protests against comic strips. Parents groups, teachers groups, religious groups advocated to newspapers that they should get rid of comic strips because they were detrimental to kids' reading, that they were teaching kids bad ideas, that they were teaching kids slang words. That resurfaced again in the early 1940s, again in the late 1940s. And the content was a little bit different each time, but certainly after World War II, there was a greater diversity of comics content. There were comics that were certainly more intended for an adult audience, such as The Serviceman Coming Back. And so, yes, there was lurid content, aggressive and sexist and racist content. You could find that in pretty much any media at the time, whether you were thinking about radio programming or film. So comics were a little bit different, for instance, than radio because of the visual element and because they were so widely accessible to kids. Kids could afford to take 10 cents to the newsstand and buy a comic book. Today, it's a little bit different because comics are a little bit harder for kids to seek out on their own. They're more expensive. But there is still that lingering fear of content that I think a lot of new media forms go through. There have been moral panics around radio, television, film, the Nickelodeon, the internet, video games, and they all share some of these same concerns about what's going to happen to the young people who interact and engage with them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
If I could just throw in something there too, you know, you can even dial that further back, and the novel was derided. I mean, they're the penny dreadfuls. They were low literature for low people, and
absolutely,
and I'm not, you know, going to defend a lot of the content that the caller rightly pointed out, you know, is not necessarily child appropriate or school appropriate, but. I think, you know, with these, the moral panic, which I think, as you said, Professor Tilley, I think that's the right way to phrase it, is the everything gets swept up, you know, and tarred with that same brush when these moral panics occur. And, you know, it's like judging the entire novel industry on 50 Shades of Grey.
And I guess there it is possible for adults who didn't read comics themselves, who thought of it as kid stuff, to see this content coming in, it might be easier to look at the content and the medium as essentially being one and the same, for as far as any dangers they saw in it.
Well, to some extent, but if you think about the people who were parents, who were professionals, who were advocating against comics in the 1940s and 50s, those were the same people who grew up reading comics in the 19-teens and 1920s that their parents advocated against. So we have a short memory sometimes when it comes to media.
Well, Jim, who just sent us an email, has his own memories of comics. He writes that, "I was raised reading Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comic books, a new one every week, 10 cents. I read them over and over and over. I was tested as an off-the-scale reader throughout my school years. I attended and taught at the U of I in the engineering department and made a living as an inventor and attribute some of my creative outlook to reading the comics. I also have a somewhat warped sense of history since I took a bit of liberty with historical events." But would you see that, would you see that as a not uncommon story from your viewpoint, that a lot of deep comic readers really got something out of it as far as their ability to comprehend literature after that and just to think?
Absolutely. One of the projects I'm working on right now is actually talking to some of the people who were kids during the 1940s and 50s who were the most avid comic readers that you can imagine. At this point in time, in the 1940s and 50s, comics were a more popular medium with young people than video games are today, which is a little bit...
Hard
to imagine. But one of the folks I spoke with, who's a retired district attorney, shared with me this story that he remembered reading, and it was something that he said he had just spoken with his adult son about. And he recounts for me this story in great textual and visual detail that he's not seen since he was 13 or 14. It was so vivid that I was able to identify right away what story it was. It was Judgment Day from one of the EC comics that dealt with issues of racism and prejudice. This was something he remembered from 60 years ago in just incredible detail. I've heard adults talk about learning to read, learning history. A gentleman told me that he learned more history from reading some of the EC Comics titles like Two-Fisted Tales than he ever learned in school.
Well, where this is Focus, I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your thoughts about comic books as we talk with Joshua Elder of Reading with Pictures and Library and Information Science Professor Carol Tilley at the University of Illinois. Our phone number is 333-9455. Our 1-800-222-9455, our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Josh, I wanted to ask you one thing. You talked about, your own experience in learning to read with comics. A lot of the things you seem to pick up on, I'm wondering, they could have come with picture books. But there's a certain thing about comics involving the sequence of pictures, of what I've heard of as sequential art. Do you think there was something about that as well? Is that something above and beyond simply text and heavy illustrations that make comics a little different?
So that's actually an area of research that Dr. David Rapp is pursuing at Northwestern. He actually started by looking at picture books and how we basically move between text and image, and how images, if they're in a sequence, how the brain makes inferences between them. He also looked at things like labeling, basically those IKEA instruction manuals and stuff like that, which really are comics fundamentally. We think of them as diagrams, and they are. But diagrams are a subset of sequential art and sequential narrative, just used to instruct rather than share a narrative. And so I'd say the more complex interplay, and of course, the fact that there were always comics that aged up with me the older I got. There was always material that I'd want to engage with the material in the format. So that's probably one of the biggest things, is
you know, once you get past a certain age, there aren't any picture books for you anymore. But there are comics, and the visual complexity of a comic or graphic novel is almost by definition greater than the complexity of a picture book. And so it's more rewarding, it's more interesting, and it's more engaging. And not to, you know, knock on picture books, I'm actually working on one right now myself. They're just different levels of complexity, and they sort of hit different sweet spots.
So I would add to that, in some of the classes I teach for people who are going to become librarians working with kids and young adults, we talk about picture books as well as comics. And there's a great definition of picture books, and I'm not going to come up with the person who originated it, but that in the best picture books, you don't know where the words end and the pictures begin. And I often use the example of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. And there's this great sequence of six pages with no words that is the wild rumpus scene. And a lot of people don't realize that there are no words for that because you've just been so drawn into what's happening. I think comics, good comics, are the same way. You don't know when the words end and the pictures begin.
Let's go to the phones again. Line one, Wally in Champaign, you're on Focus.
Okay, thank you. This is fascinating, really fascinating. I'm from the 30s and early 40s, and I grew up with the comics and the Sunday radio, read the funny papers stuff, and then I haven't missed the early part of the program. Maybe you haven't mentioned Big Little Books and Flip the Pages to get the motion picture stuff. And not to mention War Cards, which had more violence in them than I could ever imagine, and I can't even kill a fly hardly now, so I don't think that had much effect on me, but great program, and I'm sure glad comics are really getting some serious attention now. You might comment on Big Little Books, which I had quite a collection of. Over, that's a radio term. I'll just hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, yeah. Wally. The thing about Big Little Books is that you turned the page and there was another picture. So there was a picture every time you turned the page.
Yes. Big Little Books often took characters from movie serials and from comics and sort of transform them into this interesting hybrid that, so for modern day readers, it would be something like The Diary of a Wimpy Kid or Captain Underpants. It was just this weird hybrid of text and picture. But they were extraordinarily popular. They were in publication in some form up through the 1960s.
Line two, we're with Anne in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Morning. My son was an avid comic book reader, and it was interesting because he would like to collect the first issue because apparently they were quite valuable. And I don't know if you've mentioned anything about that. And I used to occasionally make derogatory remarks about it. He says, "But you've never read them. How do you know?" That was true, but anyhow, he was a big comic book reader, so I don't know if you mentioned anything about their value.
And that is something. There is a collector's market for comics. I always got the impression that maybe the bottom fell out of it a few years ago.
Oh, this was quite a...
Oh, no.
I mean, just simply because there are so many comics and so many people collecting them,
yes,
that it might have affected the overall value compared to what you could have gotten, what people thought they could have gotten, although I'm sure there's always things that people will pay hundreds of dollars for.
The Golden Age comics and a lot of the Silver Age comics still command high values, but I think that the idea of collecting comics also hits on something that's really important for kids, because a lot of kids really have that collector impulse. You know, it could be pieces of string or rocks or fireflies, but a lot of kids gravitated to comics because they wanted to have something of their own that they could hold on to and look at.
Anne, I thank you very much for your call, and I'm going to try to get one more listener in on the line. And line three, Eric in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, good morning. This is really fascinating. I haven't had a chance to listen to the whole show, so I don't know if you've already mentioned this, but I wonder if you're familiar with Robert Crumb's comic version of the Book of Genesis.
Maybe not a comic book for kids.
No, but it's an absolutely spectacular adaptation.
It's fantastic. I mean, I think it made that whole section of the Bible come alive for me in a way that it absolutely never had before.
Yes, and it was a much more faithful, I think, adaptation than many similar kinds of pursuits.
Eric, I thank you for your call. We're going to have to break it off now. I did want to get one more question over to Josh Elder. Where do things stand with the Kermit project that you're working with for a core curriculum comic book textbooks? When do you think there will be finished products that'll be out to market?
So the graphic textbook is in production right now. The first book is about, I'd say, two-thirds of the way complete, and everything, including our teacher's guide, should be done around August. And then we're looking to bring that to market in the fourth quarter of this year. And then, ideally, that's the first step of what will then become an annual event where pretty much every fall from that point on we'll be releasing at least four books out into the market, each one built around a single subject area like math or science or language arts or social studies, and all of them, again, Common Core aligned and working with, you know, just the best people in the business, people that kids want to read anyway. And we just say, all right, do what you normally do, just do it based around this topic. And our educators make sure that the facts are all right, and then we just let them run, and we get awesome comics that, you know, what we call it is a textbook that kids are actually going to want to read, and that's what we're working for.
Well, we're going to have to break it off there. I want to thank Professor Caratilli of the University of Illinois and Joshua Elder of Reading with Pictures. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. Look at the feature for today's show. You'll see links to find out more about both Caratilli and Reading with Pictures. I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WYLL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Before we get to the numbers, a quick programming note. Will Ag is out at the Farm Progress Show all this week, today, tomorrow, and Thursday as well. This afternoon at 2 o'clock on the big stage in the University of Illinois tent, Todd Gleason will do a live performance of the closing market report, and we will have a bevy of our best analysts there, probably some of the smartest analysts in the United States, all in the same tent, all at the same time. And the feature is you will be able to ask questions if you are there at the show. It is at the University of Illinois tent this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Farm Progress Show. Let's go ahead and look at and see how futures are trading. December hard red winter wheat is 7.15 and a quarter up 2. Soft December wheat is 6.67, now 68 up 1 and a quarter. September corn 5.07 and a quarter down 8 and a half. December 4.96 and a half down 4. September soybeans 14.33 and a half up 5 and 3 quarters. November 13.92 and a quarter up 2 and 3 quarters. September soybean meals 4.66.50 up 7.90. September soybean oils 44.40 down 4 cents. August live cattle 123 down 40. August feeders are 154, 67 and a half up 27 and a half. And October lean hogs are 86, 62 and a half. They're up 60. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 11 o'clock Central Time.
From WHY.